I speak to you this morning. Obviously, in our book, it talks about, it says, if you want what we have to offer and are willing to make the effort to get it, she was willing to travel halfway around the world to come here this morning and be with us. I would like to introduce to you Anna H. from Australia.
I'm Anna, I'm an addict, and I'm a member of the Balmain Sunday meeting in Sydney, Australia. And I'm really not nervous at all. I just shake like this normally. I don't know, I was really looking forward to having a topic because I could kind of, I guess, center on it a bit, you know. And when I was told that it's about my recovery, I thought, well, what I'll do is share with you a little bit about what I was like before I came here. And, like, I have a few war stories, but I really do have a hell of a lot more war stories in recovery. I don't think I missed any aspects of that. When I came into this fellowship, I had no intentions of hanging around, and I'm starting to shake here. I only really came here, I had a 10-year jail sentence hanging over my head. I didn't want to go back to jail, and I thought if I went into a, I think you call treatment centres, if I went in there that maybe, you know, I'd get something like 4 months up and I'd put a bit of weight on because I was 3.5 stone, which is something like, I think, 30 kilos. And you couldn't tell me that I was sick, you know, because I drove into this rehab in a Jag and I had a full of heroin and cocaine. And because I was only going to stay around a little bit, and I had a ticket to Puerto Rico because I thought that after I got off my jail sentence that I'd go to Puerto Rico and make some money. I was really spiritual then. I went into this rehab, and at that time NA hadn't started in Sydney, hadn't started in Australia, or I think it was called DA, and you went to DA meetings to get on, you didn't go there to get anything else but dope. And I hung around this rehab, you know, like when I came in I was really arrogant, I was really emotionally bankrupt, but I didn't know it, I was insane, but I didn't know it. I'd been so comfortable in my insanity for 16 years of my using that, you know, for me to even think about a life without drugs was really scary stuff because I couldn't see past that, you know. Like, I was really attracted to fast life. I was attracted to the insidious side of this disease, you know. Everything negative that this disease holds, you know, that was kind of my bed companion. And, you know, I used to see myself as a successful addict. You know, I could do bank robberies really good. I could borrow things and never get caught. You know, I kind of thought that I was a really hot shit, you know. I don't think that's being cussing, is it? I haven't got started yet. And, you know, so when I arrived there, I had a baby. When I was a baby myself, and he's 21 today, actually. When I went into this rehab, I thought he was 12 years old, and we had a birthday party for him, and we realized he was only 9. But you still couldn't tell me that I was kind of stepping out or anything like that, you know. And I used to like to frighten the young people in this rehab, because we used to go to what we call the sister fellowship then. And I was surrounded by 17, 18-year-olds, and I'd been using longer than them, and I'd tell them these really petrifying stories to make them kind of keep away from me, because I had this fear that if I didn't have any drugs in my system, that I had to make some type of effort to bring people into my life. And I really wasn't willing to do that, because I did that when I used and I got hurt, and I used to get busted, and I used to get a jail, and there was no way that I could trust another addict. And what happened was that, you know, they say that God works in mysterious ways. Well, my court case went for 3 years in recovery. So I hung on to my ticket for 3 years. And I stayed in rehab for 2 years, you know, for the first 2 years. And it was a really frightening experience for me because it was one of these places that you had to make a real quick change, you know. There was no kind of being indecisive about what you wanted to do. And it was my first initiation into trusting people. It was my first, you know, the things that I've learnt today about honesty and open-mindedness, spirituality, you know, having a God with no conditions and having friends in my life with no conditions. That was the very first case that I ever experienced in my life in this rehab. And I left rehab when I was 2.5 years clean, and I ended up just kind of kicking along with life. And what it suggests is that you don't kind of get emotionally involved when you come to meetings. You know, I got married when I went to meetings, and I think I picked the meanest man in the fellowship and married him because maybe there was a bit of strength there. You know? But I didn't stay married for too long. So, you know, getting into my recovery, it was like, you know, I was 3.5 years clean before I became willing to do a fourth step. And it wasn't because that I felt I couldn't put this stuff on paper. It was the fifth step that actually really scared the hell out of me, because I lived in my own cesspool for so long that I really didn't want to share that stuff with anyone, because it was the first time that I came somewhere that I hadn't felt rejection, I hadn't paid something to get in, or I hadn't had to do anything to belong to it, you know. And I got really scared that if I gave you a part of me, that you would say that I was either a little bit too sick for this stuff, or maybe I need something else. And you know, I procrastinated for 3.5 years. I went insane in those 3.5 years, you know. It was, I don't know, it was like a dry addict, you know. I'd do the first step and I'd do the 12th step considering what your backside looked like, you know. And not that I acted out on that, by the way. And I'm really nervous. I think that was my turning point, you know. I think that's when I started to surrender and realized that I didn't want to go to Puerto Rico anymore. I didn't want to isolate anymore. I didn't want to feel the loneliness that I used to feel, you know. I was okay when the lights were down. You know, I liked Anna, I liked this addict, but as soon as you turn the lights on, I couldn't look at myself as a woman. I never knew how to be a woman in recovery. I never... Is that a spiritual awakening here? you know, I knew nothing about myself. You know, I had many, many years of being very negative, being very abusive, being very tenacious, you know, but I had nothing positive about myself. And when this fellowship tried to give me something, it always felt like you were trying to take something from me, you know, and I tried to keep it to myself. And, you know, that's when I started to playing with this disease. I got a sponsor, and I was at a meeting. I was at a meeting, and I was 4 years clean when I got a sponsor. And I knew her 20 years ago when I first went into. I'd been using for about 12 years, and I ended up in a detox center. And she was there, and she saw me like 16, 17 years later. And I went up and I said to her, you know, I'm really well today, but would you like to be my sponsor? And she kind of pointed out, you know, how arrogant I was and how sick that I still was. And I didn't ring her for about 3 months. But today, you know, today we have a really nice relationship, but it's been really painful for me because just the language of people talking this fellowship, I found it really hard, you know, like the serenity and recovering and, you know, the serenity prayer and being clean. Like, I never even spoke like that on the street. You know, we had a whole different jive way of talking. And when I started to understand these steps, you know, because I came in here and I was so screwed up in the head and I was so sick, So when I actually started to put these steps into my life, that's when things start to change. I never experienced a spiritual awakening like, you know, I'd wake up and I'd feel different. It was a real gradual thing with me, and it was a gradual working these steps and starting to kind of come undone, you know, starting to feel vulnerable, starting to feel insecure, and just being able to say, I really don't know how to handle this stuff, you know. I really don't know how to be a parent in recovery, I don't know how to be a woman in recovery, and I don't know how to be a recovering addict. And this is where this fellowship came in, because I realized that with the insanity that I had, when I tried to apply my understanding of these steps, you know, you got one hell of a mixed up story, you know. But when I was able to ask people for help and learn not to move my mouth so quick, but to listen and not to have an opinion on everything that I didn't accept or that I didn't believe in, you know, not to have an opinion on that, because I was such an opinionated person when I came here, you know. I kind of jumped on the banner for all sorts of things, and I found today I really don't need to do that. There's a place in my heart for my personal stuff, which I share in coffee shops and my lounge room, but when I kind of get up here, my recovery has taken me to a journey of, you know, if you would have told me 11 years ago, you know, like I made many attempts to get out of Australia, but I was always apprehended at the airport. And, you know, when America had rung up to see if I would like to share at the World Convention, my ego went, oh yeah, this is really hot shit. And when I hung up, I thought, what the hell did you do that to yourself for, you know? I don't want to feel insecure, I don't want to feel threatened. And but I said yes, and I hadn't even got a passport, I hadn't got a visa, I hadn't done anything like that, you know. And by right, I really couldn't see myself here tonight or today, you know. I really couldn't. I didn't think that this person was worthwhile enough that I would get here. 11 years ago, I thought I'd sort of kick shit for a little while, but I wasn't going to walk this walk, you know. It was too scary for me. And I don't know, there's been, you know, for the newcomers, I hope I'm not kind of painting a bleak picture, but when I came in here, it was bleak because I had a hell of a good time when I used. I thought that using was the best next thing to anything that I had experienced. It had been a relationship that I felt extremely comfortable with, and giving that up and just having a vacuum in my life that, and the grievances that I went through, you know. My first few years of recovery was really hard because I had that fight in my head of will I, won't I, you know. I had no God. I didn't believe in God. I had conditions on everything, you know. And another Australian. You can always tell the Australians they're waving. And, you know, it's like I have gone through hardships, but the only reason that I have survived is not because Anna has got through them. I've got through them because I have a God in my life today. I've got through them because I have a group, I have peers, and I have recovering addicts, you know. I do not live a separate life. I do not have my NA identity and then my straight community identity, you know. I kind of don't wear the banner on my left arm because people hurt, you know, if they find out that you're an addict. But I don't surround myself with people that are out there to hurt me either, you know. And my recovery has had a lot of triumphs too, you know, because the only jobs that I've ever done on the street was banks. And I think I and I worked 2 years. I was going to be I did 2 years of dramatic arts, and I was going to be a real stunning actress, but I ended up knocking off their petty cash tin, and that ended my career. And I was only about 17, I think, you know. And you know, I'd like to share now with some of the things that I've got through this fellowship. And you know, I just did a fourth step a few weeks ago and did my fifth, and I used to think that I was running pretty well, you know, and every time I think that I'm in trouble because usually people tell me that I'm not really that well. And you know, this person says to me, you know, you've got such a really good grasp on the second step, you know. And I kind of started to expand you know, 6 foot across the chest. Oh, yeah, well, you know, it's cool. I've got 11 years up, you know. It's like, I know this stuff. And he says, yeah, but it's a shame you're kind of sitting on the 11th, that you're not doing anything with it, you know. And my ego was so kind of, you know, how could you say that about me? And they're, you know, they're the type of things I've been, in my recovery, I've had to deal with an illness that kind of keeps coming back. And I don't know, I get really angry towards God sometimes. I get very bitter and I keep thinking, you know, why me? You know, why can't all this stuff happen to someone else, you know? And sometimes I don't see the full picture of what God's planned for me. Sometimes I don't see where I'm going, but I know if I keep walking, I'm going to get somewhere, you know? And I know if I hang around that I will gradually, as I get balanced in my recovery, and I get a little bit more level of acceptance, and a little bit more willingness to kind of not walk over the, you know, the negative stuff anymore, but to go through it and accept it and work on it, that, you know, I will see the plan, I will see what God's got in store, you know. But there have been times, you know, I get into this feel of, sometimes, I don't know what it's like here, but over in Sydney where I come from, it's been really difficult for me at some periods having time up, because a lot of women I got clean with busted, not many women stayed around the firm, and or they moved to, one moved to America and a couple moved interstate, and that, you know, and there was kind of me, and I was so scared, you know, to put my foot out wrongly. And at nine years clean, what I did, I moved out into the country, and this is how the disease works, you know. It doesn't care whether you got years up or not, you know. It's really not, it doesn't give a hang whether you're a day clean or 50 years clean. When it attacks. And I isolated myself out of fear. I started to lie. I started to lie at meetings, tell everyone that I was really good, and I wasn't. I was in so much pain. I started to deceive myself. And I came up to Sydney, and all I wanted to do was use, you know, because I really didn't know how to say I need help. I didn't know the answers anymore. It's kind of like I came up against a brick wall, and I couldn't see past it. And I drove around Sydney, and the person I was back then, 9 years ago, was the person that was there, you know. I was as crazy as anything, and I used to sit at meetings, and all I wanted to do was bust and be a new member, because I thought that of all the stuff that I've been through, that, you know, if I was a new member, you know, if I kind of screwed someone in the fellowship when I was 30 days clean, that's cool, you know, it'll pass, it'll get better, you don't make silly mistakes. But if, you know, if you kind of screw out when you're 5 years or maybe 2 years clean, hey, that's cool, it's okay, you know, you get better. And you do stuff like this when you're 6 years clean, it's like you should know better. You really should know better. And I realize in my recovery I don't have any shoulds, because I've never ever been clean before. I've never been 11 years clean before. I've never had... you know, I've never had any of this stuff, you know. No one came to me when I was a day clean and said, hey, you know, these are 12 steps to recovery, that's one lot, but these are the guidelines and the rules that you've got to live by, because every time there's stuff like that in my life, you know, it brings up that, but why, you know, but why can't I do this? And that's what happened to me at 9 years clean, you know. All I wanted was one day clean, so someone would put their arm around me and say, hey, you're okay, you know, here, you can have this, it'll pass. And I thank God today that I didn't bust, and I guess because I wouldn't be here. That's very important. And this is my one shot at recovery. I kind of haven't backed up with this stuff, you know. And I know if I would have went out there, that I, you know, I was one person who, when I used, I used. I, you know, it was straight up. That was it. There was no kind of dabbling or anything. I didn't smoke dope. I didn't drop pills, I didn't drink alcohol, I was a highballer, which was a cocaine heroin user, you know. I didn't give a hang about all the other stuff, I went straight in there, and that's how I used them. And when I surrendered to this disease, that's kind of how my recovery has been. It's been straight up, you know. I've made many mistakes, I've made many, many decisions that, you know, I really get horrified sometimes that I actually got through. And but I've been able to make decisions, because before coming here I couldn't do that. You know, before coming here someone else always had the control, always made decisions for me. And I don't know, I really enjoy, you know, the fear and the judging that I thought that this fellowship would have towards this addict, because, you know, I might kind of fall on my face. One thing that I learned in my recovery is that you can never save face and save ass at the same time. You got to cover one or the other. And I was trying so hard to cover both of them, so you can imagine, you know, what I was going through. And, I don't know, you know, it's like after I went through that, it was, you know, sitting at meetings. I actually sat at a coffee shop, and there was this guy who was 9 days clean, and he's sitting there, and what I was doing was 90 meetings in 90 days and just talking to anyone that I could talk to. And I started to put a lot of the basic things back into my life that I missed out, like honesty. You know, when someone asks you how you are, I don't have to have a deeper meaningful, but if I'm not okay, I'm not okay. I don't have to worry about that. And this guy said to me, you know, how he was feeling insecure and the fear was in his life, and, you know, he really didn't know whether he wanted to be clean. And I was just sitting there relating so much to him, you know, and I said, yeah, I really know how it feels. And he said, oh, how many days clean are you? I said, 9 years. And, you know... I could have sworn it was 1 o'clock. It's 12:25. Jeez. Yeah, and that's what I did. I slowly went back to meetings, and I went back with them with an attitude of honesty and an attitude of letting new people in. I've been involved in service, which has been a really important part of my recovery. I found that it was extremely difficult for me when I first came here to meet people, you know. I had a problem when I came into this country, you know, because it was the first time in my life I've ever been away from Australia. It's the first time I've ever been away from my family. And, you know, I kind of got here, and usually in Sydney when I go to meetings that everyone knows me, you know, and you're centre of attraction, and it's hi and how are you, and when I came here I had to meet people. I had to go up and say I'm from Australia and that, and people say, oh, just talk to me. You don't sound Australian. And but that's, you know, the first couple of days I found that the loneliness was really incredible, and even though I was getting used to the hugging and talking to people, it's just that loneliness, you know. But, you know, 11 years ago I kind of would have put a chemical in my system to get out there, you know, and I didn't have to do that today. I had to relearn how to pray in this fellowship. I did a lot of things by automatic, you know. People would come up to me and say, you know, you've been around for so long, you must be working the steps on automatic. I never ever took dope on automatic. I had to get up, I had to hassle, I had to rort, I had to get my money, I had to go and get on, I had to stick it in my arm, you know. I mean, it was all manual, you know. I didn't kind of push a button and it all happened for me. And I used to walk around, I used to say in recovery, yeah, you know, I've got a really good insight to these steps, and it is all on automatic. But what I was really saying was that I'm really complacent, you know. I've done nothing with this stuff. I talk a lot, you know, like a show pony, like a peacock sounds good and says the right cliches and that. But that's for 1.5 hours, you know. My real recovery starts when I leave these rooms. When I go and walk... It starts by, you know, having to get up from doing a work that I may not like. It's having to learn to be tolerant to children and to other people. I've got 23 other hours to deal with, you know. Before, I would just not even know what day it was, you know. But today I know what day it is. Today I enjoy the other 23 hours. It doesn't matter you know, it doesn't matter what God puts before me. It's like I'll bark and I'll scream and I'll say, you know, I've had it. I don't want God in my life anymore, because, you know, when God's in my life, you can bet your bottom dollar there's a little bit of pain that's going to hang around there somewhere. You know? I don't want no more pain, and I want to shelve it a bit. But every time I go through stuff like that, I get through it. And I only get through it by, not with my own will, you know. I get out of it with my own will. I get through things with God's will. I get through things when I've got people around me, you know. And it doesn't happen for me in 1.5 hours. I can sit in a meeting easy for 1.5 hours, you know. In 1.5 hours I can be in Puerto Rico to Bondi Beach, you know. I can achieve great empires in 1.5 hours and not listen to anything that's going down here. And if my attitude is like that at meetings, my attitude is like that at home, you know, because if I don't listen for 1.5 hours, there's no guarantees I'm going to listen to you for another 23 hours. And this fellowship has given me the tools for that, you know. I have a family. I have a father who's a bank robber too, so I kind of picked up a few traits of him. I was chasing banks out at the age of 11. And I think I did my first one when I was 13. So I had some really good living skills given to me. I never could drive under 100 k's. I was always in a hurry, you know. It didn't matter whether I was going up the corner or just into another suburb, you know. I was always putting my foot down. Everything was fast moving. My family today, you know, my mother's kind of proud, but my mother is, I guess, the end result of living with three addicts in the family, because my brother also is in the fellowship. And I better not share about him. And I come from a family of, I don't know, you know, we kind of lived in many, many things. I guess being poor in this country is really being poor. And poor being in Australia could be, it was poor to me. But when I see what I see when I come here, you know, there's kind of a different level. And we used to live in a shack with 8 families. And when my father did a bank, we'd moved to the upper part of Sydney. I live in a really big white mansion until the police kind of moved in for a while, and we'd kind of be back down in the shacks. And I found in my growing years what I did, because I didn't know how to deal with the reality of my situation in life. I fabricated all these stories, and people used to say, you know, but I've never seen your father. And I say, oh, well, he's a professor of English, and he does a lot of traveling from university government institutions. And because I was too scared to say my father was a criminal, because, you know, you're always judged by where you come from. And, you know, I was really scared for that, and I went to 13 different schools, and I used to sell drugs there because I had no time, you know. I used to get into speed then, and I had no time for anything. That also was a very fast-moving drug. And when I left school, you know, I had a baby, and I thought, well, I've got something now to look after, you know. There's something that's mine that no one's going to take away from me. And I found out that you cannot own anything, you know, you really don't. Anything that comes in my life is a gift. I have no claims on anything. And for the grace of God that we didn't, or I didn't lose him, I managed to maintain my parenting, and I never had hassles with what we call family law or anything like that. But it's not because of what I did, it's because God kind of carried me through this. And when he realized that, you know, I was intending to give drugs up, like, this kid had 9 years, he could walk into a room and he could pick up 3 ounces of heroin and he could tell me whether I was ripped off or not. He could load a 22 in 2 minutes flat and clean it at the same time. If anyone knocked on the door, he was the one that answered it or looked out the windows. He was my protector. He always told me what was happening in the darkness that I never saw or heard, you know. And this was like 9 years of his life. He had you know, he was a very quiet boy at school because he was always suffering. He didn't know how to communicate. And And growing up in this fellowship with him, it's just been an incredible journey for me, because these are things, you know, when I came into these rooms, I would listen to speakers who would share about all these really nice things happening, and I'd be sitting there and I'd think, oh man, you don't even know what it's like, you know. You really don't know what it's like to be a real addict. Because I thought I was a real addict, and they were kind of just passing through, you know. They hadn't left their mark on the street like I had. And so it was really easy for them to put it down, and they looked so healthy, you know. I expected when I came into the fellowship of people sniffling and kind of doing the shuffle and doing, you know, the real physical traits that we have when we get off drugs, and I didn't see any of that. I heard money in the pocket. I saw clean clothes. You know, I used to hate sitting next to an addict that was, you know, when I was going through detox, that they were going through detox, because the smell that would come out of my pores, you know. And I used to think, but where are all these people? And I listened, and I think I could never achieve any of this stuff for me. You know, I had never been achiever in my life. I would sabotage things. I'd build them, and I'd create nice little empires, and then I'd just destroy them bit by bit. And I'd do that with relationships. I do that with friends in my life, you know. And that's all the stuff that I could see, that if I stay clean, hey, you know, I might put a bit of weight on, my attitude might change a little, but that's kind of what I've got to contend with. And I thank God today it's not like that. If my recovery, you know, if my recovery is like a fraction of the days that I had on the street, I'm hanging around for another 50 years, you know, because it's my recovery, even though there's been pain in there, has not even touched the sides of being a using addict and having to deal with the despair and the anguish, the isolation, the pain, and the just not knowing, you know, not fitting in and doing things really different, you know. I'll hang around for a while, and I don't know, this fellowship, I can really rave on for hours and hours what this fellowship has given me, but I've also seen a lot of people lose stuff in the fellowship too. It scares me when I hear people busting. It scares me when, you know, someone's got 7 years up or something and they go out and they do a little bit more research, you know, because I used to come to meetings and I'd look at the stars, you know, the people who would say to me, you know, a bit of smoker is not going to hurt you, or, you know, a drink's not going to hurt you and stuff. And they were saying to me, you know, we're going to go out and use. And I think, oh, no, I can't because I got caught. So, you know, really good luck. And they were my heroes because I thought that they could do it, you know, that they really looked like that they were just going to go out there and have a little bit. And I'd see them 12 months later, and I'd see them with their backside out of their pants. I see the humiliation that this disease can give you, you know. I've seen it on their face. And it often reminds me of, you know, something like being a three-year-old kid and stuck in a shopping centre and only seeing people's kneecaps, not ever seeing past that, not ever seeing a way out. And I don't want that today, you know. There has not been anyone or anything in my recovery that has made me one of us. I have set myself up for things that have not been spiritual, that have not been the way of NA, you know, but I've learned. I've tried really hard today not to make the same mistake twice. I try really hard not to keep backing up. You know, like those toys that you wind up and you set them in another direction but they're still slammed against the wall, you know. That was like my 3.5 years of recovery, because I knew it all. And, you know, when you know it all you're doing is bashing your head against the wall. And I don't want that stuff today, you know. It's a, you're a really bad headache. I don't know if I'm sounding too serious here, you know, but my recovery, when I look back, there's a lot of humorous stuff that's happened to me that I think, oh, you know, how embarrassing, you know, you shouldn't have done that. But it is pretty serious for me, because it's life-threatening stuff, you know. I only have to be at the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong thoughts, and there's no guarantee what my actions are going to be. I found that I had to change, you know, the people that I hung with, and I was really attracted to, you know, the groovers of Sydney and stuff like that, the kind of the dead growth side of life. I was really attracted to that, And just breaking away from that was like breaking away from drugs too, you know. And I had to, when I let go of something, another door opened for me. And I don't know, it's like, it's been a journey into the unknown for me, except the only thing I do know is God's there. And the only thing that I do know is people are there. It's not a journey just into Anna on her own totally, because that really frightens the hell out of me. I'm going through kind of, I guess a painful situation for me now, because when I left on Tuesday, well, the Thursday prior, I've been kind of sick, you know, through my recovery, and it's been really difficult. I don't know if people find it over here, but when you have other physical problems that could be life-threatening, whether it be a sociable, acceptable disease or not, it's really hard to share about this stuff without having people react around you, or kind of, you know, have a political opinion about it, or tell you all the things that you should do. And it's really hard to share that. And through my recovery, I've had to deal with an illness that is life-threatening, but I was really kind of selective with people that I shared about it with. And we started up an illness and recovery meeting in Sydney about 3 weeks ago, and I was like, and it's like, you know, 11 years, when I first got clean at 3 months, I was told I had 18 months to live, and I think that's the Irish in me, the arrogance, we hang around a little bit longer. And, you know, like, it's so nice, you know, and this is what this fellowship has given me, and it's like for the first time in my recovery, I've been able to go to a meeting. And every meeting that I've gone to, whether it be an ID, a speaker's meeting, steps, women's meeting, any special topic meeting, I've always worked out whether I haven't got pearls of wisdom from it, but I have felt that degree better. You know, I have always felt that degree better if my attitude is in the room, you know. And it was the first time in my recovery that I was able to go to this meeting and just dump it, you know. Just sort of sit down and say, well, look, I've been carrying this shit around me for a long time, and here it is. And it was such a, I don't know, to me it was a real spiritual thing, because it was such a feeling having everyone in that room really relating to where you're at, you know. People there for different reasons, but the whole bonding of that meeting, and that wouldn't happen outside of this fellowship, you know. I go to a care group. So sometimes I'm sitting there and I think, oh, man, I'm so far away from this stuff, you know. I feel like I'm just so big, you know, and so mature, and I'm not, you know. I'm so little and I'm so kid-like. But when I go to this meeting and do or say what I feel like without kind of the fear of being ostracized or alienated, you know, it is such a pleasure. And that's only with this fellowship as a whole. This fellowship as a whole has been able to care for people like me in recovery, you know. It isn't just an ID meeting because I'm an addict. There has not been an addict that's come into this room that hasn't needed special needs, you know. We all basically have the same issues. We all suffer with the same disease, but there are other problems that we have, you know, whether it be with our sexuality, whether it be with us as being parents, whether you have illnesses that you don't want to talk about, whether you have, you know, physical problems. I mean, we all have something. I've not yet met a perfect physical, mental, spiritual recovery addict yet, you know, besides myself. And, yeah, so, you know, that's the gift of this fellowship. As a woman in recovery, when I came to these meetings, I wouldn't shower, you know, like if in this rehab you had to have a community shower and stuff, there's no way that you would get me to take my clothes off in front of anyone, you know. If you went to bed with me, you went to bed with a light down, I was fully dressed, and that's the way it went. Because I really could not accept myself unconditionally for what I had and for what I was. I always wanted to be someone else. I always wanted someone else's body,
someone else's hair, someone else's face, you know. And what I had to learn was to start to love myself. I kind of cleaned up a little bit on the outside, but the thing that was doing most damage was the stuff inside. And other women in this fellowship helped me through that, you know. It wasn't, you know, I can be like a performing fool, you know, I can play as many acceptance games as the newcomer. But the thing that's going to help me through, if I'm going through any type of a problem with a woman in recovery, it's other women in recovery that help me through this. So. And, you know, I found it really difficult. I was kind of reversed. I was really comfortable with women because I hadn't really been hurt by women. But in recovery, just having a relationship, you know, friendship with a man was really difficult for me because I was so full of anger and I was so full of resentment and I wanted to blame, you know, I wanted to blame people for where I was today. And it was kind of, I used to justify because when 2 days before I went to court, you know, my final trial, and I was saying it was the second remandment that I went up. The guy that ran with rehab, you know, he was kind of an oldest gentleman, and he was the first man that I ever trusted in my life, you know, that I actually met him. And I didn't know that he had plans for me. And I realized, you know, that 2 days, if I was bonded to this court, to this rehab, and if I was to leave myself or be discharged, I had to do part of my 10-year sentence, and I really didn't want to go back there. And 2 days before I went to court, this guy kind of took advantage of me, and because it was me, I thought, well, you know, I can either do it with this person, or if I don't, I was going to be discharged. And that really tarnished me, you know, and I judged every man in this fellowship on this person's action. And I realized that this is one individual, only one, 1,000, just one person who had hurt me, you know. And it had been men that have helped me through a lot of pain in my recovery. But, you know, God, you can see God working because most of my peers in Sydney are male. Most of my peers, you know, like when I end up in hospital for a while, which I usually do on a monthly basis, you know, it's the guys that kind of come around and check me out and see if I'm okay and stuff like that. And I never had that, you know, I never had that on the street. And it was, you know, the resentment that I had, you know, it didn't just go away. I didn't leave it alone because when I leave, you know, it's like having a sore, you know. If I leave it alone, you know, the scab may fall off, but the scarring is still there. And I really didn't need the scarring. That was what I had to deal with. And I learned, you know, I learned through many men in my life, and I'm not talking on a sexual level. I'm talking on another recovering addict, you know. I don't see male or female addicts, I see recovering addicts. I don't put tags on people. You know, I try really hard not to do that because I don't like to get overshadowed by women who don't understand. I don't like that going to me, so I try really hard today not to do that to people. And, you know, I found that it was people that got me through this, that, you know, some of the people I originally got close to after I got through this pain and through resentment, I was helped with my peers, you know, that I think I've been over in this country a few times, and that has been so powerful for me because I really feel that if that didn't happen, that I could have been one of these women, well, not these women, but a woman who would have got clean in women's meetings, but I would never step out after that, you know. And I'm a woman in recovery, but there's a hell of a lot more to me, you know. That's a part of Anna, but Anna as a whole is a person in recovery, and I try and work many roads with this stuff, you know, not just try and look after a little bit of my needs. And I find that if I do that and if I only go to one specific type of meeting, I'm not opening myself up to hear other stuff to come in. I'm not allowing myself to grow. I become emotionally stunted in recovery, you know, and I've been there. I've been insane in recovery. you know, I've been judgy. I've been, you know, everything, like I said, that I want, you know, I've been there over and over. And, last night when I went back after, they had a grouping last night, and it was just so good to hear live music. It was so good to rock and roll. It was really good, on my own too, I might add. And just to go back to the motel room, and everyone kept saying to me, did you have a really good sleep last night? And I woke up every hour. I've never ever been early for a meeting since I've been here, you know, and I was here at 8:45, and I wasn't a bit scared at all. I've met so many really beautiful people, and I say that really honestly, because it's a real threatening feeling for me, you know. In Australia, when we know you, we shake your hands. It's a real Anglo-Saxon tradition. I like you, but don't come too close to me. But here, you know, people help you break down those physical barriers, and they throw their arms around you. And that can be such a confronting thing for someone like me, because I'm not used to it. You know, usually if I throw my arms around you, you know, it's because I've known you for 35 years or something. And that has been such a learning experience for me, you know, because I feel really comfortable with that today. And I didn't, you know, 3 days ago, it was kind of, whoa, you're getting too close here. And just sort of settling into a fellowship that is so big here, and the meetings have been really, I don't even think powerful is the right word for me, you know, because like you're looking at a person who never dreamt that she would ever be standing at a world convention sharing her story, you know. I never even conceived that. I used to think that, to be quite honest, I never even thought about it. You know, I never even allowed myself to think past Sydney, you know. And when I went to my speaker meeting with Balmain, it was my 11th birthday, and they were taping it, and it was one of these no-frills business. When you're very rarely honest, but it happens to be on that night that you're honest, and I was, you know, sort of mucking around on the tape and stuff, and then someone said, oh, why don't you send it over? And I thought, no, you know, it was that instant, hey, you're only listening to me for 20 minutes. There's another 95% that you don't know. There's another 95% that you don't know what I've got away with, that you don't know, you know, what a fake I am, and the facades of recovery, you know. You don't know all these things about me, you know. What happens is, you know, you like the tape, and I come over, and then when I'm telling my story, you realize how much of a fake I am. Just all these really positive attributions that you give yourself. So what I did was, you know, put some Neil Young music on the back in case you didn't like my story. I heard he was around. And it was a real surprise for me, because when I received the phone call, I really thought it was someone in Sydney with a car phone just mucking around saying they were from America. And I thought it was a friend of mine, and I really felt like saying, yeah, you're feeling lonely, you want to ring me. the poor guy, I think it was Martin on the end of the phone, he must have thought he got a borderline retard on the other end. And when I hung up, I cried for 3 days. I could not believe that this would happen to this addict. I really didn't, you know. And then I thought, you know, it'd be cool. You know, I thought, well, there were 16 years of my ego when I used. Maybe I could bring a little bit of that to say when I fall on my ass, the blow's not going to be that painful. when it became out of sight, it wasn't a problem. And then when I started to get a little bit closer to coming here, I thought of all the things that I should say and all the things, you know, the great wealth of wisdom that I have somewhere. I just don't have it right now. You know, I would love to be able to, you know, put my hand in my pocket and pull out all this stuff that has helped me day to day for 11 years, but I'm only talking for an hour. It's taken 11 years to get here, and you know, it wouldn't have happened if there wasn't a World Convention, and it wouldn't happen if there wasn't people who were willing to sit down and listen to my tape, and there wasn't. I would not have got here if it wasn't for people, for Recovery Aid, to put in money in the trays, to be able to support me while I'm over here, you know. When I was in jail, my last time in jail, I was using about a half ounce in 2 days, and I was just under 3 stone, and I sat in the cell. And they, over in this particular jail, they really like to watch people cold turkey. They get some type of perverse pleasure out of it. And I actually thought that I was going insane. And when I used to pray on the street, it'd be like bartering, you know, look, if you do this for me, God, I'll be good, and I won't use, and I won't get on tonight. And when I got on, I kind of prayed the next day when I was hanging out. And I was in this cell, and you know, like when you're hanging out, you don't want to eat. And you know, the ladies working, they would bring in really big meals, so it would make you a bit nauseous. And I remember I sat there, and my hair at that time was down my backside, and I was all in leather, and I had pink and grey tiles on the floor, and I spat cleaned those tiles for 2 months. Because I had nothing to center on. I never felt that I had a God. I felt God deserted me as soon as I stuck a needle in my arm. And to be quite honest, I never gave God a 2 minute thought, only if I was in a really compromising or threatening situation did I pull tabs on it. But I never really put much effort into it. And I cleaned those tiles because it was the only thing that I could center on. And I cleaned and whisked it every hour on the hour. And, you know, people used to think that I'd keep away from Anna because she's a little bit out there, you know. A little bit. I hadn't even been there to be out there. And two people from the fellowship came to see me. And they were telling me how life was, you know, how beautiful. And I mean, these women were like King Bassingers, you know. They were beautiful, they looked beautiful, they sound beautiful, and I looked at them and I threw a chair at them and a table at them and told them to go away until they were real addicts. Until they'd been using for 7 years and come back and talk to me, you know. And one of those women today is still clean. She doesn't go to meetings, which is really sad. I guess that's a judgmental statement, but, you know. That's the way it is, but she's still clean. But she kind of helped me when I came out of jail for 8 weeks walking around Sydney. This is how insane I was. I went in to do a bank, and there was one of the banks in the middle of Sydney. Had those glass doors, and I went up and I had a change of mind. You know, I'm not going to do this, and I was so scared that I actually ran in the glass doors and locked myself unconscious. That's not really a la carte in the world that I used to come from, you know. And the gun fell out, and I'd only been out of jail 24 hours. And I was trying to tell him I was pregnant, that I fainted. And I don't know why, but for the grace of God, I never got busted. And I left that day, and I used for a few weeks, and I had this jag, and I drove around in this jag without a stitch of clothes on for 2 days getting on, and you couldn't tell this addict that I was insane while I was out there, you know. I ran from this place up one of the main streets of Sydney with a pair of football socks on and nothing else. But I was cool, you know. I was always cool. They held it together. And that's, you know, the type of history that I came from. It's I don't know, you know, like it's a gift of the journey with me. The insanity that I felt, I'll never forget, you know, people come up and say, you know, wow, 11 years clean, you can't relate to a new member anymore. And I think, you're kidding, that's right, that's what keeps me here, you know. It keeps me here because I don't forget days like that. You know, I may not remember, you know, the 16 years of my using, and it's easy for me to remember how easy it was sometimes, and the laughs and, you know, the good times that I had. But the thing that has kept me here today is because I was crippled, and I didn't know it, and I was bankrupt, and I didn't know it, and I was suicidal, and I didn't know it. And when you're at a place that you don't know, that's a really scary position to be in. And that's why, you know, when I see new members come in, I see that pain, you know, that the question mark of what the hell am I doing here, I'm in the wrong room. I really relate to that because, you know, it doesn't matter how much that I grow in my recovery, it's new members that keep me growing. You know, I don't kind of just magically, you know, explain myself and get all this stuff. It's new members that come to meetings that keep telling me there's nothing out there for you anymore, and there's nothing out there, because if there was, they wouldn't be here, you know. And I thank God. You know, I thank God that there is a place for this addict to go, because, you know, if I was to tell my story somewhere else, whether it be medically or clinically, that, you know, I could possibly be put away for a while. I've only told you the real gentle stuff, you know. But today, you know, today I'm a productive worker. I think I'm a productive worker. I set up legal exchange programs in Sydney. I work with HIV. But you know, it's not a job, I guess, in my life that I kind of get into the head to anything like that. It's a job that I get to meet people like me, except the only difference is that there's a syringe there and they're doing it and I'm not doing it. But I also am very aware of how this disease can attack, you know, because it really is an insidious disease. And it tells me that I'm traveling really good when I'm not. And it tells me that I'm feeling fine when I'm not. So there are real precautions that if I'm doing exchange programs, that, you know, I look after Anna because I'm priority in my life. So I don't sit down and, you know, I can't hang with people who smoke dope around me. I can't hang with people who shoot up in the bedroom, you know. I can't do stuff like that, you know. And to be quite honest, I don't know if I want to. Because when people do that around me, my head is back there 11 years, you know. My head is out there to what I used to be like. And these meetings remind me what I'm like. They remind me the facts about this addict. I don't need the street to remind me of that. I find it important for me to share about some of my using past, because it's a really good center for me, because that's where I came from. I didn't come from these rooms out to the street. I came from the streets into these rooms to live a life on the street, you know. I was really hoping that all you people would be really tired and you wouldn't turn on. I would. I can handle rejection today, you know. But I don't know. This is the first time in my recovery in the last few years that I've been a single woman in recovery. And that has opened a lot of issues. So, you know, when you come, I came from jail to rehab to marriage, you know, and I'm not saying marriage is an institution, but my head was in an institution, you know, and I got married for the wrong reasons, and, you know, the person that I did marry was a very good man, you know, but we kind of grew apart, you know. When you come out of rehab or you build a relationship in rehab, I wish you well, because I've kind of, I've, I went through that myself, and I know the pain. The first relationship in recovery that doesn't work is a real painful experience, and a lot of people walk out of these rooms to rooms over things like that, you know. And I could have been one of them, but, you know, for the grace of God, I wasn't. And this is the first time, you know, that I haven't come out of an institution. And it's the first time that, you know, I've been an adult in recovery, or part of, I'm trying. And today, you know, I have a relationship with my son that, you know, he doesn't have to come in and ship the dope out anymore. He doesn't have to, he doesn't have to tell me if the police are after me. He doesn't have to do anything negative, you know. And it's really funny because with me being kind of, I see myself as a young mother, you know, and he's kind of 2 feet taller than me. And, you know, he's not short for telling me that I might need to increase my meetings and stuff like that. But, you know, the beauty of this fellowship is that I'm not kind of, you know, a sole parent. I am a sole parent, but in hanging around these rooms, you know, when you're single and you don't have children, there are so many things, you know, so many things to channel yourself into. And when you're a sole parent, there are so many things that you can learn about parenting that I've not learned anywhere else. And it's only by other people going through that. You know, I found that I believe that if I didn't bring my child into this fellowship, that there could have been a chance that he would have been, you know, kind of out there emotionally and mentally, maybe not using, but being so emotionally stunted, and just coming to meetings and having the interaction with other children and watching behaviours and learning from other people. You know, he's grown up to be, you know, he's pretty conservative. People say, you know, that they're really amazed that he's my kid. Because my kid by right should be, you know, blowing face and doing drugs and checking out your house and stuff, you know. And I, you know, yet, he has not yet done that. I don't know if he's going to intend to have an occupation in the area, I hope not. Might have to get away CA with me. Sorry, that was a joke. I really don't know what else to share about. You know, I would like to say thank you to the committee for having me here. For, you know, like when I came in on Thursday night, I'm staying at a really nice hotel. I've never stayed at a nice hotel before, even in recovery. It's still the unaffordable or the affordable ones for me, and I'm not usually quite nice. And I've walked in to this room and like two people who I never knew before came and picked me up. And I walked in and there's a big basket of fruit and a welcoming card, and I didn't get that on my wedding night, you know. And that was just such a beautiful introduction for me, you know, because it was like, we don't know you, but we know you. And you may not feel part of, but you are. You're one of us. And I would really like to thank the committee. I would like to thank the TAPE committee for listening to me, because I really don't, the majority of times I don't feel that I have got much to give, but what I have got, you're welcome to it. I have, and, you know, all you people for making my stay, I don't know the words to explain it, but when you come from another country into a world convention and they say, you're not just having one state person, you're having a multitude of different people from all over the world, you know, that's just such an incredible feeling, and everyone just wants to know you. And the information that I've got, you know, from all the other sharers and speakers at the meetings, I would like to thank you for giving me something today, because it's, you know, it's been one of the most incredible journeys this weekend, and it really is. I believe that, as I said before, by right, you know, I shouldn't be here, but God willing, I'm here, and I would just like to thank you for letting me be part of this, you know. And you're all very much welcome to stay at my house in Sydney. Thank you.